Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and here today we've got Josh Feit, the news and politics editor at Seattle Metropolitan, where he writes their politics blog, Publicola. Hiya, Josh.
Hey.
From the Seattle Globalist, co-founder of that news site, Sarah Studeville. Nice to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel, political analyst KCTS9 Public TV. Welcome, Joni.
Hello there.
Let's get at the top stories of the week and see what we can learn about it. This week, the Seattle Times wrote that Seattle's government is giving liberal lobbyists special access. An advocacy group proposes some legislation, and the city council introduces that legislation almost word for word. Sometimes a lobbyist gets to sit literally at the table with council members recommending wording. Joni, is Seattle letting lobbyists in too far?
Well, I was really happy to see this piece because I did wonder what the heck is going on at City Hall. What is the city council up to? Where are some of these pieces of legislation that are head scratchers coming from? So I was very happy to see that piece.
Well, what's wrong with letting interested parties who know their stuff propose this legislation?
It's fine for them to propose, but it's the city council's job to actually refine it and make it make sense. And some of it hasn't made sense. I think that's really what was going on there.
What hasn't made sense?
Well, for one thing, the homeless legislation that is penned by the ACLU and Columbia Legal Services. It comes in, it sets some precedents that are very troublesome.
Isn't that up to the city to then make it better?
That's the deal. They're not making it better. They're making it a little bit better. But this is, unfortunately, if you remember ye olde district elections here, brought in a bunch of very, very lefty. There's sort of a contest down there to see who can be more lefty. Rookies. I mean, you know, look, these groups have hovered around City Hall for a very, very long time. It takes smart, competent people to work on if they like the idea, they should be refining it. They should be fixing it.
Okay.
They should not be taking in. Let's just take the idea of homeless encampments in the parks. Just take that as one example. Anybody remember? There's almost unlimited money available to parks that could be transferred, that could be taken advantage of. The city council has a job to do the, you know, if these other folks are writing the bills, what do we need the city council for?
Okay. Well, and when we say the city council should make it better or refine it, that, of course, depends on your point of view. But Josh Feit, what do you think?
You know, I think we have to back up and point out that the facts in this article were inaccurate. So the examples that were given were factually wrong. So let's start with the Times' two examples that they gave. First of all, they talked about a move-in fee bill for landlords. They were going to regulate move-in fees, right? And the article said that that was written by Washington Can Community Action Network. Untrue. That was a bill that the council has been working on. Washington Can, which advocates for that, jumped on board and advocated for a bill that council is working on. Additionally, the other main example, and Joni brought it up, the supposed ACLU bill. That bill is now being changed significantly, and in fact—
This is about homeless encampments,
right.
How long you have a right to be where you are.
That's right, regulating homeless encampments. The ACLU, as a public interest group, a group with the public interest in mind, has every right, and people do this all the time, to bring legislation for legislation. It is the council's job to, as Joni said, refine it. That's exactly what's happening, and in fact— Lisa Herbold, who is the main ally, Councilmember Lisa Herbold, who's the main ally of the ACLU and the Columbia Legal Service on this bill, she said on the record in her correspondence with her constituents to me as a reporter, quote, this bill needs to change significantly.
Okay.
And they are and guess what? What the legislators are doing right now? That's what they're doing. They're changing it significantly, including what they're doing is they're creating definitions for what is unsuitable. So let's just start with the facts of the article.
Okay.
We're wrong.
Okay. Before I get to you, Sarah, because you're so diametrically opposed, I just want Joni to get a chance to react to that. There's Josh saying this is how it's supposed to work.
So the beauty will be in the eye of the beholder here. So what if, I'll just ask you, Josh, my good friend here, if, I don't know, Amazon or a real estate lobbyist
right.
came in and said,
this was a corporate.
Hey, baby, here's a bill. We wrote this. You can fix it, but wink, wink, we're all on this sort of social justice thing. We're all grooving along here. I mean, you can change a few things, but let's get the stuff that we really want in this bill. Sound good? Sound like fun?
Here's what it sounds like. It sounds like it happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would say to that, Joni, is yes, the left is very quick in an opening salvo when they're criticizing legislation that is written by lobbyists that work for for-profit corporations to point that out. So if the pharmaceutical industry is writing a pharmaceutical bill, yes, the left is going to lead with, hey, that's a problem. But then they follow it up with a critique and they document what is wrong with the bill. What no one has done is particularly on this landlord bill, has documented what the problem. I'm happy for someone to say, hey, whoa, gotcha left. You know, you guys are writing bills. They then need to follow up that soundbite with a critique that tells them what's wrong. And I didn't see Wes Neaton's article or Schofield document what the problems were. So that's my second
okay,
issue.
So more reporter to come on that. Sarah, what do you make of these different arguments about whether the city of Seattle is letting lobbyists, liberal or not, in too far, letting them write legislation to too much of an extent?
Yeah, so this was a new issue for me. And as I was reading Danny's article and some of the follow-up articles, I was sort of struck by what I think Josh is getting at and this idea that, well, the status quo is that big businesses have their lobbies all over our local politics. And this idea that they're trying to sort of get new people to the table, I think is an argument that deserves some attention here. And I felt like the framing was a little disingenuous, this idea that we weren't doing this before. And now all of a sudden, because a bunch of lefty progressive lobbyists showed up, now we're just letting them, you know, write bills part and parcel. That felt a little disingenuous.
Okay, Joni, 2-1.
That's good. Those are good numbers for me.
It's a
big day for me, actually.
What's your argument?
So my argument is that just because business used to do this, or we feel affronted by the fact that business used to do this, well, now let's just open the other door and let the other people come in and write the bills. We have a city council. They could use some seasoning. Many of them are new. This is their job. They can take ideas. I'm all about take ideas. But don't pass or even attempt to pass bills that just came in like that. That's not good legislating.
Okay, before we leave this, we haven't talked about our responsibility, us listening, listeners who are voters. Whatever the measure is, somebody introduces it, left, right, council member had a dream that night before, however it gets introduced, the council then debates it, they can amend it. If you're a citizen of Seattle, you get to then tell your council member what you think of their work, right? What's the problem?
Again, I don't see a problem here. And I want to point out there was another example in this reporting where they pointed out an ACLU bill that supposedly was run through without, you know, council knowledge. It lost. The council voted it down 6-3. This was about sweeping encampments. So, again, this is factually inaccurate. And I really want to second the point that not only this isn't simply a rebalancing. We're talking about two different actors when we talk about for-profit corporations and lobbyists and landlords who have a financial interest in the bills they're putting forward.
Absolutely.
Versus a public interest group like Washington Community Action Network, who doesn't stand to profit from the legislation.
Okay.
They're acting in the public interest.
Okay, it's time to move on. I will give Joni the last word because she's outnumbered, and then we're going to move. We're going to talk about the rest of the news of the week.
I'll just say I don't like the equivalence here. I think that, you know, we want a city council that writes their own legislation, input from the community, and I don't think we want any of these groups. Basically, they're embarrassing the council. We talked about this word in the green room, embarrassing.
Yes.
By saying,
more
to
say,
we know better than you. Here's a bill that we need, and oh, hey, we don't have a profit matter, so just pass it.
Okay.
Party on.
Well, we are putting thanks to the Seattle Times for spotlighting it, and we're critiquing and spotlighting it further. And let's pay attention to how the city or wherever you live, your city, your county, your state, your local, your government, pay attention to how they do what they do. And then you get to go to public hearings and you get to vote yourself. You do have a responsibility here, too. We're going to talk more coming up on the news of the Week in Review. Continuing the news of the week now, the Week in Review is Sarah Studeville, Joni Balter, Josh Feit. I'm Bill Radke. This week, KUOW gave you both sides of the carbon tax initiative coming to your fall ballot. Our EarthFix reporter Ashley Ahern summarized the pitch from supporters.
If you could make energy companies pay $25 for every ton of CO2 they emitted, would you? Okay, now how about if that tax meant your gasoline cost 25 cents more per gallon and your electric bill went up? But to sweeten the deal, let's say the revenue from that tax was used to reduce the state taxes on sales and businesses, and some of the money went back to low-income families in the form of a rebate.
Ashley talked with supporters and opponents like the environmental justice group Puget Sound Sage, where Rebecca Soldana says this carbon tax initiative leaves behind poor people and communities of color.
Spending $100 on groceries and being able to have 1% of that less in sales tax is not going to make their families healthier. It's not going to clean their air. It's not going to create the infrastructure investments that we need to do. That's the part that's unfortunate.
Josh, is this not an interesting debate that environmentalists themselves are having about this carbon tax initiative now that we're supposed to decide this fall on our ballot?
Yeah, it's super interesting, right? You obviously have had the environmental left for a long time wanting to put a price on carbon, and that's what's happening. You simultaneously have the environmental left, particularly the social justice overlap on the environmental left, arguing that the mechanism that the 732 proposes leaves people of color out and sort of exacerbates problems for low-income people. And I think that's a fascinating debate, and it's a good debate for the left to be having.
Sarah Studeville, anything you can say that would help our listeners figure out where they should stand on this?
Yeah, so I agree with Josh. I'm actually thrilled that this debate is happening because I feel like for too long here in the Pacific Northwest, environmentalism has been this issue that's kind of apart and separate from other social justice issues related to racial equity and income inequality. And this is really forcing, I think, environmentalists who too often are wealthy white liberals, right, to say, why does environmentalism look like this in this region? Why are we having such a hard time building a meaningful coalition and really getting the groundswell going here that Seattle should have going for it? Because this is a city that should be leading a meaningful environmental movement, and we don't see that happening yet. So to me, I think it's really exciting that this debate is happening.
Will you say more about this, Sarah? Explain how social justice fits into this environmental question, this carbon tax initiative?
So as far as I understand, there's two really big pieces here. And one is just that from the very beginning, this initiative didn't bring the right people to the table. It wasn't reaching out to a lot of nonprofits and organizations who've been working on that intersection of racial equity and income inequality and green issues.
Who really suffers from pollution,
like
for
example? From pollution and really sort of starting there first and saying, what do we need to do to make sure that these issues are addressed and addressed properly in your community, right? So right out the gate, it was kind of set up to fail, I think, when it comes to those constituents. And then there's how the bill actually functions. And a big piece of that is just that there's nothing to stop these carbon taxes or this extra money that polluters are asked to pay from being passed on to consumers. And we all know that that's going to hit low-income consumers the hardest.
So, yeah, we featured this conversation on Civic Cocktail earlier this week. Your first blush of this is you'd think, well, carbon tax, the state of Washington, that's the most natural place in the world to pass a good one. And it was really hard to tell, you know, is this the right one or not? Should you wait for one or should you go with this? Because at least it gets us started and maybe the legislature could fix. Josh, you like that. But the gist of this, think about this, too. So low-income people who will see electricity bills and gas bills and everything go up.
It's more expensive to pollute utilities, et cetera.
But what you have here is you have this absolute immediate tax cut, sales tax, that's supposed to benefit you. But if we approve Sound Transit, you're not going to really feel that, much of that, because Sound Transit raises the sales tax. So it's not going to be this great, oh, I got this gift from Initiative 732. And then on the other side, you'll have like this slow uptick of this new system of revenue coming from the carbon taxes. So that's where people are going to get squished in the middle of that. That's one of the concerns. The other one, of course, is this whole little wonky thing about whether or not this statewide initiative is revenue neutral. Oh, my. So we were promised that. We were told that. And then the State Office of Financial Management comes out and says, oh, no, this is going to cost over 6 years something like $800 million. So that puts it in a fight with education. So that's where this thing is really, really getting pushed from a lot of different sides.
I was just going to add on the specific policy question why this is bad for low-income people and where it overlaps with the social justice movement is that, yes, there is this kind of offset reduction in sales taxes and also a rebate to low-income people. But that doesn't get at the larger problem with global warming. And basically, what it ends up doing, you need a more systemic fix than just kind of an offset. And what ends up happening here is that poorer people are going to get high, they're going to be paying more to drive, and we're not giving them an alternative to driving. And I think what people want to see from a carbon, when we're taxing carbon, is you want to put that money back into ways that give people options, right? The gas tax, raising price on gases, this is not elastic for low-income people. They have to
drive.
They're
going to drive anyway.
You're going to drive. And so if we're not addressing the fundamental environmental question of our infrastructure, of our transportation system, of mass transit system, we're not helping poor people. And we're keeping them, we're basically taxing them.
Okay, well then I'll leave the final word to anybody who wants to rebut in favor of carbon tax before we move on. Okay, have we said it all? Something you want to get in about this decision? We'll say much more about this. And by the way, I did kind of hosted a mini debate with one of the supporters and one of the opponents, as well as Ashley Ahern kind of profiling this. So I recommend you go to KUOW.org, and then you've got all kinds of sources you can link to educate yourself and figure out whether this is the carbon tax initiative you want or not.
I was just going to say really quickly that the cap system that Jay Inslee proposed, it didn't make it through the legislature, probably would get at the idea of actually making carbon more expensive for polluters.
And I'll just say really quickly that this is the kind of law that does not really lend itself wonderfully to the initiative process because, as you know, once it's written and put before the voters, it can't be changed without a vote of two-thirds of the legislature for the first 2 years. And so there's some things that could be adjusted in here if this were just legislation for the legislature.
Okay, more resources at KUOW.org. Before we started the show, we had a rousing conversation that I want to get at right now. We're talking with Joni Balter and Josh Feit and Sarah Studeville, co-founder of the news site The Seattle Globalist, on the subject of presidential election. We were saying, we started with, what does the Globe think about Donald Trump? International actors weigh in about Trump? And then should we be embarrassed by Donald Trump? So first, what's your take from the Globalist?
Yeah. So, I mean, this idea of what does the Globe think of Trump? I don't think I'm going to surprise anybody by saying that much of the Globe seems terrified of a Trump presidency, especially with his attitudes towards immigration, towards refugees, his sort of unnuanced is not even the right way to put it, right? His approach to just diplomacy in general and the war on terror. But we were also talking about how we see these kinds of leaders in other countries, right? In places like the Philippines and in Russia. So while the United States isn't unique in this idea that we have this bombastic, sort of super conservative leader, possibly, you know, becoming our president, I think the implication here for the rest of the world, since we are arguably the most powerful country in the world, is huge, right?
Okay. Yes.
So, but this embarrassment piece of it,
yes,
that we were talking about.
Yeah, there are demagogues around the world. The United States is hardly a bastion of perfection from the very founding of this country on. So we were just, I was saying that embarrassment just doesn't, is not in my color palette. You could be concerned, you can be a lot of things about Donald Trump, whatever you feel, but embarrassment doesn't come to mind. And it seems a little privileged or a little naive to me to feel, oh, I feel so bad about what others might think of me. It's about me.
Well, it isn't about me or you. I think what we were trying to say with this word embarrassment, but you don't embarrass easily, which is good considering the job that you have. Mm-hmm. But Donald Trump has brought us to a very insult-driven campaign. It's very kind of gross and vulgar. I can only quote my mother here who said, he's no president, you know, and the gist of what she's saying is he just doesn't have the sort of conduct, even though he has the best temperament. I have the best temperament.
Right.
He doesn't have the best temperament to be president. He seems like, like about an eighth grade boy, something like that.
Josh Feit, does that embarrass you?
You know, I think rather than embarrassed, I think the word I would use is frustrated, that we have so many serious issues in the country right now. violence against African-American men, obviously a top line. We've just talked about global warming. And you don't see that, you did not see this discussed in any detail or depth at the debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And what you saw was Donald Trump insulting beauty pageant winners. And, you know, we've seen through the debate him talking about his penis size. It's frustrating to have this kind of, and this maybe is where the embarrassment factor comes in, but this clownish character.
Okay.
Kind of belittle very serious issues.
Okay, and finally, Sarah, last word on embarrassment.
Yeah, I'd go one step further there and say I think the embarrassment is kind of a reflection of Donald Trump showing to many of us and the rest of the world where we actually are as a country, right?
That too much truth?
Maybe it's too much truth that as many as 40% of the country's population, right, or the voting population, sees him as a good leader, agrees with his position on things like immigration and the way he talks about race and the way he talks about class and the way he talks about women. I think a lot of us here in Seattle would have liked to have thought that we're a little further along as a country, right? And maybe that's not who we are. And here we are now faced with the possibility that, in fact, that is exactly who at least half of us are.
Sarah Studeville, Joni Balter, Josh Feit, more to come here on KUOW's Week in Review, safe injection sites in Seattle, Catholic football, rivalries, and more. So stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's Week in Review, live tweeting the show, as always, at KUOW. We'd like to hear from you. Joni Balter, Sarah Studeville, Josh Feit. I'm Bill Radke. Josh, you went to a briefing this week on the safe injection sites that Seattle is considering. Will you first just remind some of us what are safe injection sites and why does Seattle's mayor want them here?
Yeah, and let me just start by saying I think the term is safe consumption.
Safe consumption.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Basically, and not only would these sites or a site allow people to use needles to do drugs, basically heroin, but they'd also allow people to consume drugs inhalation style and crack cocaine and other illegal drugs. So it's not just injection.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, yeah, I think we all know a couple of weeks ago there was a task force report that recommended a radical idea because it has not happened in the United States of allowing a safe consumption site. Also kind of extending, making it broader access to what's called, I can't pronounce it, buprenorphine.
Buprenorphine.
No. But which is similar to methadone, although it's not as high a dosage, and so it's able to be prescribed and not just used in a clinic. So there's some accessibility issues, and sort of broaden that approach. The mayor, when the task force report came out a couple of weeks ago, supported that idea. And what happened this week was it went in front of council, and there was a council briefing, and the council seemed very supportive. I think that was the news that the council seemed well aware that there would probably be opposition to siting a place like this in a neighborhood.
It actually has to be someplace.
It has to be someplace.
Like,
the recommendation was for one somewhere in King County and for somewhere in Seattle, because this is coming at the county level. And
do we know where this would go?
No. They don't. They're really at the early stages, and I've asked, and there is no budgeting for this yet. The council is kind of looking at questions about where do they want to site it, what will it cost, what are the legal issues. But I think the news for me this week at the briefing was to see the council seemed all in. They seemed well aware that there would be neighborhood opposition and willing sort of to really, to use their term, educate the public about why this actually does not create a public safety problem. It solves a public safety problem is the way that they were viewing it. And we'll see where it goes with the budget. Again, they have budget session is now in play, and President Harrell, Council President Harrell, and Council Member Psy Bagshaw is kind of leading this issue. Have both recognized that this is a moment to get moving on this during the budget. I don't know what's going to happen with that though.
We don't have all the details. I don't know if you know the answer, but I've wondered. There's a nurse there as people are consuming, and can the nurse gradually reduce your dosage so you could shoot up there for whatever it is, 6 months until you're off heroin? Do you know if there's any intention around this to get people off of the drugs they're hooked on?
I think the idea is to get people into treatment. The first idea is safety, right? Mm-hmm. Getting people inside in a regulated environment is both safer for the public and safer for them. And so I think the philosophy that accompanies this is that you have kind of a one-stop shop where you both have social services, and you have bupe, and you have methadone, and you can talk to people about that. And what one of the interesting statistics that the presenter from the University of Washington, who presented to council this week, said is that 80% of the people who are addicts don't want to be. They want the opportunity to not be doing this. So I think that's a compelling thing to look at, that they recognize this is a problem and want to do something about it.
Okay. Sarah Studeville from The Globalist, have you followed Vancouver, BC's experiment with safe consumption sites?
You know, not as The Globalist. I mean, and I personally have spent some time up there.
Have you?
Seen what it looks like just as casually as a visitor, and talked to friends who live up there about it.
What's your take?
And my take is that I think that this is ultimately a good thing. And I absolutely agree with Josh, and it sounds like the council, on this idea that getting people inside into a regulated area is actually the safest way, and that that kind of harm reduction approach to addiction is really the right choice for a city that frankly has the population, the homeless population that we do. I'm curious about where these are going to go, especially as we already see so much controversy over where homeless encampments go, and a lot of not in my backyard sort of attitudes about the homeless population. I'm interested in the idea that now everybody seems to be like kind of on board, right? But this idea that it's a foregone conclusion, I'm not convinced. I think that there's probably more controversy to come.
Joni?
Well, I think it'll happen, and I think the idea of a pilot project is a pretty good approach. What I like about this is that, look, the law enforcement approach isn't really working, is it? So I think we ought to go move on to the public health approach, which, as you mentioned, the treatment is, you know, getting folks safe first, into treatment next is the wise way to go. I don't think, as a city, want to become like the heroin magnet for the U.S. or anything like that. But I think if we manage this well, and if we do well with it, if we have success stories, if we, you know, instead of busting everybody, now we have people where we're helping them to be safe first, and then we get them to treatment, we are making progress, and that should be something that the city council should approve.
Okay, wrap this up for us, Josh.
Yeah, and Joni's put her finger on a really important point, and that's the law enforcement part. And the reason I think you're seeing a lot of unanimity around this issue is because law enforcement agrees. They have experience with another kind of experimental or experimental idea, which is the LEAD program, which is law enforcement couples with social service agencies and public defenders to move people into social services rather than arresting them for low-level drug offenses. That has educated law enforcement, and they are very much supportive of this. What you have found in other parts in the country where people have pushed this idea, I think Ithaca, New York, perhaps, San Francisco, perhaps, you find that law enforcement, one of the stakeholders, has come out against it. I will say the other stakeholders that often come out against it is a political because of the NIMBY issue. So those are the two places where you run into problems. We're not running into the law enforcement problem here.
Okay, so you think foregone conclusion is too extreme? Odds of this happening in Seattle,
Lincoln
County? Look,
you have siting problems when you want to build a house. You have siting problems when you want to put in a new store, when you want to put in a bar. So you're going to have siting problems. I think it's going to be it's going to be hyper-localized. And I think generally the public is going to be very impressed with this philosophy. And I think it'll happen.
On KUOW's Week in Review, giant football players and indistinguishable Huskies and Ducks. Stay tuned. Your Week in Review panel this week is the news and politics editor at Seattle Metropolitan, writer of the politics blog Publicola, Josh Veit, and from the Seattle Globalist, Sarah Studeville, from Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel, Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke. This week, people across America have been reading about the high school football team nobody wants to play. That was the CBS headline. The Catholic school Archbishop Murphy in Everett is private, which means they can attract the best players from 50 miles around. You don't have to live in the district like for a public school. So Archbishop Murphy players are good, and they're big. Some of them, and they always blow out their opponents. So public schools are just refusing to play. They're forfeiting the games. Joni, those public schools, a bunch of quitters, right?
No, not at all. This private schools playing public schools, we are finding, quite clearly, is a mismatch. And you touched on it. So the private schools can recruit big, large people, 300 pounds and so. Not all of them, certainly not. But then you get into some of these smaller towns and their public high school, they can, you know, their catchment area, if that's the right word, is smaller. So I actually think this has to be fixed at the state level, that these are a mismatch and they can be fixed. I can tell you my son desperately wanted to play football for Garfield High School. He has a beautiful throwing arm. And I was the mean mom there. I said no football at all, not because of the mismatch, just because football's dangerous. And with all this attention to concussions and injuries, I really think this needs to be fixed. I think that's what we've learned this week.
Exactly. Football is dangerous. There's always smaller players being tackled by bigger players. You could always have an injury. So there's this idea that they're Goliaths on this team. They're bigger. Not times three. And as a matter of fact, Issaquah is the last public high school to go ahead and play Archbishop Murphy. They lost 73-0. If anybody got injured, I didn't find out about it. 2 weeks later, Issaquah got up and beat Inglemore 40-7. You're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Did we convince you, either one of us, Sarah?
Well, this is a little off my beat. Fair enough. It's interesting. And as a proud graduate of Seattle's public school system, right? I mean, I just sort of relate to this on the public versus private rivalry, right? And this idea that underfunded public schools are asked to play a better funded private school that already has all of these advantages. I'm just, you know, come on.
Here's the thing.
Not fair.
Josh, when I played public high school soccer in Omaha, we'd have to play Creighton Prep every damn year. I was the goalie.
Tough, huh?
Every 2 minutes I would look up and there'd be 5 6-foot Creighton Prep players stampeding toward me while deciding amongst themselves who will get to score on me this time. Like, after you. I've scored twice on this guy. We didn't consider quitting. It was just Creighton Prep was better than us. The best players wanted to play there. They probably got expensive instruction from coaches with British accents, and I accepted it because that's life.
Well, I would say you put your finger on a big difference. So you're talking about soccer, and
yeah.
I think Joni flagged.
I think Joni flagged the
you know, the danger issue in football. And for me, this is not my beat either. But my reaction to this story is that it really does highlight the concussion issue and the danger issue. I mean, I was going to bring up basketball. You know, you don't see teams that are much more talented walloping other teams and people forfeiting all the time. But there is a scary issue at play here in football.
Yeah.
And so, but to me, that's what this is raising again another question that we've been seeing the past couple of years about this sport. And, you know, should we be encouraging young people to do it?
Okay. So poor Archbishop Murphy, they were all ready to play. Friday night after Friday night, they don't get to play because you agreed until you got this idea that they're giants and they're going to crush our skulls. And then so nobody gets to
play.
Well,
one other thought here. Those small town public schools, there's nothing they'd like more than to play football on a Friday night.
That's my point.
They really, really, really look forward to it. So this tells you how much this is a discrepancy in size.
That's fair.
And that's one question I had about this. Is it partially that they're doing this in protest of these kind of unfair advantages?
That's
injury,
also fair.
Injury
maybe
prevention
so.
By the parents.
No, but maybe they're saying, yeah, public schools ought to be separated from private schools because of that recruitment reason. Yeah. Okay, that's fair. This week, did you feel the Duck hatred, by the way, going around?
I feel it every week.
Do you? Okay. You hate the Ducks?
Yeah, a little bit.
This is for you. The Huskies are playing Oregon tomorrow in football. Oregon has beaten Washington like a dozen games in a row. Probably will be
that
different
be
this year.
What's driving that? Yeah.
But I don't just hear Husky fans say, we really want to win that big game. I hear them say, I hate Oregon. And this week I talked to an expert on rivalries from Sports Illustrated. John Wertheim said a lot of the biggest rivalries are between cities and players who are almost exactly alike.
This is mirror image time. I mean, these are the service academies have this fierce rivalry, yet you could just as easily have gone to West Point as Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
You could just as easily have gone to Duke as North Carolina, Oregon as Washington. it's really a quirk and an irony of rivalries that you have so much similarity.
Husky fans, you hate Oregon because they are you.
And they beat us 1,000 times in recent years. That could have something to do with
How dare they? Yeah. Well, by the way, psychologists say humans love rivalries because we're tribal. We are wired to privilege our group over other groups.
Yeah, and let's be honest, there's a rivalry between Washington and Oregon and between Seattle and Portland that is very, very real. And while I may not follow college football all that closely, right, as soon as I started making that connection, I'm like, oh, is this a Seattle versus Portland thing? All right, then I hate the Ducks. So, yeah, that inclination towards rivalry is very strong.
Eugene, Portland, close enough. And for example, if you're a motorist, you might hate bicyclists enough to scatter tacks on the ground where they ride. Have you heard about this? Seattle cyclists have been reporting flat tires because of tacks on the new Westlake Avenue cycle track. And there's this enmity, this four wheels versus two wheels rivalry. And we don't know for sure why the tacks are there. But if you find any, Seattle police ask you to please pick them up and go scatter them wherever you see an Oregon Duck tailgate party. This has been KOW's Week in Review. Joni Balters, no, they did not really. Joni Balters, Sarah Studeville, Josh Feit, thanks for coming in and smartening us up about the news of the week.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Great to talk with you. We're live tweeting at KOW, and you are tuned in to listener-supported KUOW Seattle.